Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll meet a farmer cellist. But first, as we age, we become more vulnerable, and sadly, there are people who abuse and take advantage of older adults. We'll talk about what puts elders and dependent adults at risk, how we can protect them and ourselves, and we'll find out what's being done right now to stop this abuse from happening. We also want to hear from you. Have you or a loved one been a victim of elder abuse? Share your story. Give us a call at 866-780-9100, or you can send email to talkofiowa.com. At iowapublicradio.org. With me now is Celine Gogarty, Polk County Assistant Attorney. The Polk County Attorney's Office has a Dependent Adult and Elder Abuse Unit, which was created in 2002. At that time, it was the only unit like this in the state. Hello, Celine.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Now, tell me a little bit about this unit, the Dependent Adult and Elder Abuse Unit that was created in 2002. What is the mission?
Well, John Sarcone, the Polk County attorney, realized years ago that this was a serious problem and we needed to address it. So he specially assigned a prosecutor to investigate these cases with law enforcement to prosecute them and also to do community reach out to the community because this is a serious problem. We have a very vulnerable population. And if it's a, kind of a specialty area, so you really need to know what you're looking for and how to identify it and how to properly prosecute it.
Well, let's try to get a handle on how serious this problem is. It's hard to pin down statistics on something that is, I guess, difficult to identify at times. How would you characterize how big a problem this is in Iowa?
It's a big problem, especially in a state like Iowa, which has a larger aging population. Nationwide studies have indicated the rate of elder abuse is about 10% of seniors will be exploited, neglected, or abused. And just to put that in perspective, the rate of child abuse is 12%. Mm-hmm. So it's not that much different. However, the reporting rates are very different. About 33% of child abuse is reported. That's a terrible statistic, should be higher reported. But only 4% of elder abuse gets reported. And financial exploitation, the largest component of elder abuse, it only gets reported at a rate of about 2%. So we're completely missing the problem, which is, and it's serious. Yeah. People have their entire life savings often just completely gone.
Well, and let's focus in on that financial abuse. We'll talk about some of the other kinds of abuse as well. And often there's more than one kind of abuse going on at the same time. But financial abuse, that is the biggest problem. How do you characterize that?
I would absolutely agree. That's the biggest problem we have. That's the largest part component of elder abuse. What's really troubling is that if you have financial abuse, you also usually have another type of abuse to go along with it. Commonly, neglect is a big one. But the cases we often see are not cases where someone has had $200 stolen. It's more likely $200,000 stolen.
Yeah. They can lose their whole life savings.
Yes, life savings. Their homes are lost. They don't get to pick the facilities they need to be in. And it's emotionally devastating. There's research indicating that in the 3 years after someone has been abused, neglected, or exploited as a senior, their mortality rate increases 300%. And I'll tell you anecdotally, I know in my cases that happens all the time where my victims die while the case is pending.
So describe how this seems to work. I mean, I think that we can imagine if someone is a home health care professional, that there could be an opportunity to take something that's laying around the house. But when you're talking about people losing their whole life savings, how does that happen?
Well, it's usually a family member, which is horrifying. One of my colleagues likes to describe it as the perpetrators of this are the ones sitting at your Thanksgiving table. That's the one who's doing it. And it often occurs using, or abusing a power of attorney document. People think that they get power of attorney over someone, it's a blank check, and that's absolutely not true. You're supposed to be acting as an agent, acting in that person's best interest. Instead, they get a generic power of attorney because most people don't put restrictions in them, and then they just, the money, blow through that money, vacations, you know, going out to eat, and usually they have nothing to show for it. And it's almost always a family member, usually an adult child. I've been a prosecutor for almost 23 years. I've prosecuted everything from phishing to murder cases, and these cases still shock me. You'd think I wouldn't be shocked by anything, but they are just stunning what people would do to their own family.
So give us some advice. I mean, a power of attorney document is something that a lot of us need to have as our parents age or as we age. We need somebody who can make those decisions and take care of things that we can't take care of. A power of attorney document can be incredibly useful. So if you need one, how do you create a power of attorney document that also gives you some protection?
I think it's really important when you're creating a power of attorney document that you really think about what you want it to do. Do you want this person to pay your bills? Do you want them to maybe get some money out to pay Christmas gifts, pay for Christmas gifts? Really think about exactly what you want and spend a little money and talk to an attorney and make sure you put restrictions in it. Maybe it's a restriction that the person who's acting as your agent, sometimes known as the power of attorney, can only spend money, a certain amount of money for themselves, or they need to get permission from a second person that this is acceptable, that they need to make sure that they have restrictions in there, and make sure everyone knows what your intent is. Document right in there that I want my bills paid. That's what I want to see happen with my money. Otherwise, I want it saved for my heirs to have when I eventually pass away. Something like that. Make sure everyone knows and you're talking about it. That's what I would give to people so they can protect themselves. And what I've seen is that actually has helped on cases where when they have those restrictions in there, it makes it a lot easier to shut it down and stop it before it gets out of control.
Now, of course, for a lot of people, finding one reliable person who can help them with something like this is enough of a challenge. Would you recommend having a safeguard by trying to involve more than one person in your power of attorney so that people are watching each other?
For a financial, I don't think that's a bad idea. Or, you know, putting something in there that they have to provide an accounting to the other, like their other siblings, for example. The more eyes, the better. I think that's most of these cases occur because people get isolated, and they think no one's watching. If someone's watching, it's a lot less likely to happen. The research has indicated that elder abuse is caused by two things. One is power and control, which is more the traditional neglect, abuse, things like that. But the other big component is greed. So if no one is watching, the greed can go unchecked.
Well, and we're going to talk a little later on about financial conservators and what they can do to help in this situation as well. But I want to kind of run through the list. So financial abuse may be the biggest problem, but there are many other kinds of elder abuse or dependent adult abuse that can also take place. Domestic abuse is one, and that's one of those things that can go unseen or unreported, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the way to think about it is that if someone has not really been held accountable for being domestically violent in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, why would it stop when they reach their 50s, 60s, and 70s? It's a big problem. And so certainly actual physical abuse is a significant component of elder abuse.
Sexual abuse is also a problem. I mean, we've had some really heartbreaking cases reported in the news from care facilities. But that's something that I think a lot of people don't think about with older people. I guess we don't associate older people and sex in many ways. Or what is the danger here?
Well, what's really important to remember is that sexual assault is not about sexual desire. It is a tool to assault someone. The sex is the tool for the assault. And as sexual assault is the most invasive, horrific kind of an assault short of killing someone. And so we have to get over I think some people get squeamish the thought of that, you know, that this people wouldn't do this. But you have to remember it's not about sexual desire. It's about power and control. And oftentimes perpetrators would look for vulnerable people. And if someone has dementia, living in their own home, have no one to look out for them, they're easy prey.
How about neglect?
Neglect is a big one. We'll see a whole range of neglect. It starts with self-neglect, which is basically someone that has lost the ability to care for themselves in a safe manner. And then it ranges up to a criminal neglect where literally family members will watch their grandmother rot away on the couch in front of them until they die. That happens here in Iowa. It happens a lot. It's just not getting the news. And it's horrifying. We've had cases where people literally are infested with bugs, along with terrible bed sores and sitting in their own feces. So it's a serious problem.
Now, this kind of abuse you mentioned, often perpetrated by family members, although this is something that a lot of us fear when we invite or hire a home health care worker or put a loved one in a care facility. I mean, this is something that could happen anywhere, right?
Absolutely. It can happen anywhere. It can happen in facilities. I've prosecuted cases that have occurred throughout the range of the community. It's what's really important is that the people that care about their seniors need to be looking out on them. So if they're in a facility, don't come at the same time to visit. Come at random times. If they're in their own home, visit at random times. Find out who's stopping by. People with dementia who live in their own homes are at a very high risk of being abused, neglected, or exploited. So it's really important that we look out for people who are in their own homes that have dementia.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking this hour about elder abuse, some of the dangers that our older citizens face, and also things that are being done to stop this kind of abuse from taking place, things that we can do to protect our loved ones and to protect ourselves as we age. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me right now is Celine Gogarty. She's Polk County Assistant Attorney. The Polk County Attorney's Office has a Dependent Adult and Elder Abuse Unit. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll meet a farmer cellist. Right now, we're talking about elder abuse. We're talking about financial abuse of elders, where life savings can be wiped away, neglect, domestic abuse, sexual abuse. With me, Celine Gogarty, Polk County Assistant Attorney. And we're going to focus right now on prevention of elder abuse. And I want to bring somebody else into the conversation. Brandon Kranovich is Director of Health Center Operations at Wesley Acres in Des Moines. Wesley Acres is an independent living facility in Des Moines, part of Wesley Life, which runs a variety of facilities in Iowa, including independent and assisted living. Hello, Brandon.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here today. So let's talk about prevention. We've talked about how elder abuse can occur in any environment, at home, in a facility. What do you feel is the key to preventing abuse?
I think the key really is education and training. At Wesley Life, and in healthcare in general, we are all mandatory reporters. So we are actively involved annually in continuing education, and we complete the state-approved dependent adult prevention training. I think it's also really important that as a community of health and well-being, we are the advocates for our community, the population that we serve. So it's our job to recognize the warning signs and intervene.
All right. So let's talk about that training. What kinds of things are you taught to look for?
So we are taught about the six types of elder adult abuse. We are taught to watch for sudden changes in behavior, interactions with families, As they come in and out of our communities. We watch for sudden changes in powers of attorney or wills that come across, you know, our table. It's really about identifying so that we can prevent potential risks and getting ahead of it if there's the potential at all.
Now, as a living facility, you see changes to power of attorney and wills when people make changes?
Sometimes we do. We have residents. As they age, they sometimes need more help with financial or medical care, and we have a lot of interaction with those powers of attorney for health care and for financial. So we see that across our table all the time. And, you know, mostly it's just as a – we're here to help you as a support system. But we do see those changes sometimes. And as an advocate for the resident, which we have to be because we see them every day, it's important for us to be open and aware.
Now, of course, you're talking about your employees keeping an eye on interactions with individuals who would come into the care facility to visit and interact with somebody who lives in your facility. Of course, a lot of us also are worried about the people who work in a care facility. What kind of safeguards can you take as a care facility to make sure that your employees don't abuse your residents?
You are correct. So education is really our first line of defense. We also, before anyone is ever even hired in a healthcare facility, we provide or we complete extensive background checks. We go through all of the training. Before an employee will ever work on the floor, we have them go through the state-approved dependent adult abuse training. So it's really education and monitoring from the get-go and teaching our team how to be advocates for the population that we serve.
And with people having different roles within a facility, do you try to create a safety net, safeguards, so that, as Celine was saying, more eyes are on a patient, more eyes are on a resident?
Absolutely.
Celine, I know that training about elder abuse is something that you're involved with at the Polk County Attorney's Office, training for law enforcement, for example. What kinds of things can you teach people so that they will be aware of what's going on and enter a situation without some of the preconceived notions that can hide this kind of abuse?
Yeah, that's correct. We are actively involved in the grant with the Iowa Attorney General's Office to educate law enforcement and professionals throughout the state. We've trained about 650 people in the last year and a half. But, you know, I think the biggest thing when it comes down to when we're training law enforcement to look for elder abuse is, first of all, take their blinders off and just not assume that what they're called out for is really what's going on, because these cases can be subtle. But there's one word in their arsenal, I think, that is really is the biggest tool they can have, and that's the word why. Why is something happening? Why is this person not taking their medications? Is it because they can't afford them because all their money's been stolen? Is it because someone has stolen the meds and is using them or selling them? Is it someone trying to take the meds to control their behavior as a way of another medical neglect? So that is what it really comes down to, is why is someone in this situation? And it's amazing when you start asking that question and really start peeling back the layers, the information you get.
Well, and you mentioned money, which, you know, we talked about financial abuse earlier. Is that one of those things that should set off some red flags? If someone, say, should have cash on hand but never seems to have any money when they need it?
Absolutely. That is a huge red flag. You know, other red flags are when someone is acting as a power of attorney and says things like, I'm power of attorney, I can do what I want. That's a huge red flag. You know, if things don't add up, if things don't make sense, that's when the time when we want expect our law enforcement, we expect people who are looking out for our seniors to ask that question, why? Why does it not add up? And figure out what is really going on.
We have this email from Jane in Fairfield. She says, my mom is well taken care of in her 90s, although she has Alzheimer's. About 2 years ago, we had to hire someone extra for overnight stays. The person who stayed overnight was a known quantity who had also taken care of some of my mother's friends. However, it came out later that she was stealing my mom's pain medicine, oxycodone and fentanyl, and selling it. And she also stole a lot of silver. All of that while my mom was asleep at night. My observation in hindsight is that this can easily easily happen, even when people are being vigilant. In every other way, my mother was and is benevolently and vigilantly taken care of, yet this still happened under the radar. There are people who make a career of doing this kind of thing, and this was one of those people. Now, I don't want to make it sound like home health care workers have a very, very difficult job, and there are a lot of wonderful people working very hard in this field right now. But listening to that story, Celine, how could Jane have protected her mom in that situation? That sounds like someone who had good references.
You know, unfortunately, we can't prevent every crime. What's really important is to talk to the senior. It's really fascinating is that a lot of times the seniors, even ones with dementia, will know exactly what's going on as far as they know when they've been assaulted. There's been studies where when asked people how they got bruises, if they're inflicted, even people with dementia know that those bruises were inflicted. People remember trauma. If her mother was complaining of pain, that should have been a red flag. Well, why is mom in pain? Isn't she getting her pain meds? Maybe we should have her, you know, her levels checked. You have to be vigilant, and I'm not criticizing because hindsight's 20/20.
Well, and of course, you just want your loved one to be well taken care of, and if someone gains your trust, it can be easy to abuse.
Absolutely, and some of these people, and it's not necessarily home health care aides or anyone else. Anyone who has access can do this, but they groom. You know, you hear that. Phrase used on or sexual predators, they're grooming their victims so they basically get are prepared to abuse them and then they don't get caught. Some of these predators groom people or seniors so they earn their trust and then they start taking money, taking loans that they never intend to pay, tell them stories. I prosecuted a case, this person's actually in prison where she took care of this gentleman's wife while the wife was dying, and he came to trust her. Well, then she eventually bilked him out of over $100,000. And his family didn't know, and it got discovered inadvertently because she groomed him.
Here's a comment from Diane in Mason City. She says, another great resource for individuals facing these issues is Iowa Legal Aid and our elder hotline. Our main number, 800-523-1275, and our hotline number, 800-992-8161. We give help in all 99 Iowa counties. Celine, do you feel like things are getting better as far as people being aware and being able to access help when something goes wrong?
I think we are slowly starting to wake up to this reality. I've been working in this area since 2009 as far as elder abuse goes, and we are slowly making progress. It's also important to, if you suspect essentially a senior or any dependent adult who is suffering abuse, if you suspect that abuse, you call Department of Human Services, and that number is 800-362-2178. That's 800-362-2178. But we have made progress. There is a civil elder abuse petition where you or a loved one can petition on your behalf the court under Chapter 235F and request assistance from the court. That went into effect in 2014. So to have that additional resource is great. People are starting to come together, all these different agencies, and starting to work together. And that's a very positive thing.
I want to bring Jody Selby into the conversation. She works to protect people from this kind of abuse as a financial conservator. Hello, Jody.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And first of all, describe for us what a financial conservator is.
You know, a conservator comes in. Sometimes it's Celine that will contact me or the Department of Human Services or another attorney. And they are appointed by the courts to come in and take over the financial side when somebody is unable to handle their financial finances for themselves.
All right. And how do you qualify to be a financial conservator?
You know, it was I've been doing this now about 10 years, and it was an application process through the state where I applied, and there was background checks that they did, and then once I was approved, now I'm on their list of approved conservators, and so when they have a situation or a case where somebody needs a conservator, that's when I'm contacted. And if I'm available to take the case, I will.
So this is something that you do almost always as a volunteer. What prompted you to become a financial conservator?
Well, about 10 years ago, I think it would have been Celine's predecessor in this particular role, and I were visiting, and he was explaining to me the need for, I'm in banking, and he was explaining to me the need for somebody to help individuals manage their finances that have assets that don't necessarily rise to the level of a trust, because there's trust services, and those are usually large amounts of assets, and there's fees associated with it, but they have assets that need managed, and they're always looking for people to serve as conservators. And I thought, well, I can do that. That's one of the things that I can do. I'm pretty good at managing finances. And I said, well, I can do that, and I have time on my hands, so I would be happy to serve in that capacity. So that's kind of how I got started. And I generally have a rule where I will only the most I'll take at any time is six. So six is kind of my cap.
And so how much time do you spend doing this?
It can vary. It depends on the situation, and it depends on the individual's how many, what we're looking at for assets that they might have. If it's somebody that's already living in a retirement facility, and so there's not, a home involved or a vehicle or that type of thing, it doesn't require a lot of time. It's just paying their monthly bills. If there's somebody that has a home and, there's the transition from the home to a care facility, then that takes a little bit longer. Or I've had a situation where there was somebody that owned farmland and they leased that farmland, so that required a little bit of extra time. So it can just depend.
And I can imagine that there's always a need for people who would volunteer to go through this process and become conservators, Jody.
Yes, I think Celine would tell you that, and if you were to talk to the Department of Human Services, I think they are always looking for qualified individuals.
All right. Well,
because you have to be, and you have to be bondable. I mean, that's right. You have to be able to be able to attain a bond, and not everybody is bondable. So.
Well, Jody, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for doing this work. I'm sure you've helped a lot of people. Jody Selby is a financial conservator, mostly as a volunteer. And I want to get to the phones. Lynn is on the line in Ames. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, much like Jody, I'm a professional guardian and conservator. And my question is, there's a lot of this going on, and as a mandatory reporter, I do see it, but I wanted to ask, what is going to change as far as consequences and punishment for people who are found guilty of either financial exploitation or abuse of an elder? I have run into that where a family member or a friend it's been founded, but that's the end of it. There is no punishment. There is no consequence for that. And it's very frustrating for myself and the family when that happens, and then that's where it ends.
Well, Celine, I'll let you respond to that.
Sure. And that's one of the reasons that the Attorney General's office got this grant, is so we can train law enforcement to properly collect evidence. These cases can be trickier than the average case because often we have a victim who does not have the ability to testify because they have dementia. They may be reluctant to cooperate with the prosecution because this is a family member often. And so what we've really been focusing in on our training is, okay, how do we find evidence that's credible and admissible so we can prosecute cases? And we can do it. Well, we prosecute lots of cases in Polk County, lots of financial exploitation. In fact, those are the most common ones that we do prosecute. It's just a matter of taking your time and looking for that evidence and finding the evidence and doing a proper investigation.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that often if there's one kind of abuse, there is often another kind of abuse going on as well. So if you do encounter a situation where there's one kind of abuse, is it a good idea especially to check into finances to see what's going on there?
Absolutely. That's very common on neglect cases because a lot of times they're not taking care of them because they're stealing the money. It's not unusual for someone to be pulled out of a nursing home who needs 24-hour nursing care and then because family members don't want to pay for the nursing home bill because it's going to cut into their inheritance. And so those go hand in hand. And that also gives us the motive. What's the motive for the neglect? Why would you do this? And it's usually greed.
Well, we only have about 30 seconds left. If you suspect abuse of someone in your life, what do you do?
You call your local law enforcement and you call DHS, and that's that 800 number, 800-362-2178.
All right. Celine Gogarty, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Celine Gogarty, Polk County Assistant Attorney. And also Brandon Kranovich, thank you.
Thank you.
Brandon Kranovich, Director of Health Center Operations at Wesley Acres in Des Moines. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to meet a farmer cellist. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Craig Holtgren has a very interesting job title. He calls himself a farmer cellist. He lives in Decorah. He helps out on a family farm. And he also travels the country performing experimental music on his cello and other instruments. And he is on the line with me now. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Charity. Good to talk with you this morning.
Well, delightful to talk with you. And I know that you have been a professional musician for a long time. You've had a long career. Tell us a little bit about what you have done before moving back to Iowa. You grew up in Davenport, but you spent a number of years with the Alabama Symphony, right?
Right. Yeah. A number is maybe a little bit of a misnomer. I played for 33 seasons down in the Alabama Symphony, and that's a full-time regional orchestra. And you know, they work every day for 42 weeks out of the season, and it was. Well, you know, that was my professional life for 33 years, but I also then ventured into other things like teaching and then my passion, which is contemporary and new music.
All right, so tell us a little bit about that, contemporary and new music. How do you define that?
Well, basically it's like classical music and living composers creating compositions in today's life and artistic venue. I work as an improviser. I have worked closely with composers for the last 25 years or so. I've had about a little less than 300 works that have been created for me. And what I do is I give voice to our modern day living composers. Not to say that I don't play all of the standard repertoire as well, but my passion, my interest, and really what I am known for is what we would call the new music, the new art music. But I also work with songwriters and in more popular veins as well, and that is always a good challenge for me as well.
All right, well, we're going to play a little bit of one of your songs so people get a handle on some of what you do. It's actually a couple excerpts put together from a song called I Understand You Perfectly by Melissa Gray. All right, that is a little bit of I Understand You Perfectly by Melissa Gray. I'm not sure I understand it perfectly, Craig. So,
well, as indeed you should, because in what you have there is just the electronic component. And I play a lot of electronic music, and this piece is designed for me to improvise over the top of on my electric cello. And what we've cobbled together there is actually just the electronic component without my performance. So it is a little bit more difficult to understand. What I do a lot is some people would call it experimental music. Things that really challenge the norms and boundaries of what we consider to be to be music. Sometimes it's music without necessarily much of a melody or much of the typical ethos of emotions or whatnot. But that's what I'm about. I am a provocative artist and like to get people to talk about what they hear and what they didn't hear. And you articulated it beautifully, Charity.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about the kind of music that appeals to you. But I want to go back to that job title, Farmer Cellist. What brought you back to Iowa?
Well, I'm from Iowa originally. My uncle was the director of the Twin Springs Fish Hatchery for the Department of Natural Resources up here in Decorah for many years. He retired and then shortly thereafter developed an inoperable brain tumor. And my aunt and uncle live in the eastern part of Winnesheek County on 12 and a half acres of gloriously beautiful country. I refer to it as God's country. And my aunt needed help taking care of my uncle and taking care of the two barns, the house, the three pastures, the 12 and a half acres, plus taking care of my uncle. And so that's what prompted me to make a career change out of orchestral work down in Alabama and to come back up here to my original roots here in Iowa.
So there was a family need, but this was also something you'd been itching to do.
Right. Well, I'd been playing in the orchestra for many seasons, and I really wanted to devote myself to new music. I did the professional work and acquitted myself well for many decades, but what I needed and wanted to do was to present the works of our own time, pieces that have been written for me. I wanted to go out on tour rather than always having to hustle back to Alabama for the next rehearsal or concert. And so it was both a professional move and a family move, and it's been working out excellently.
When did you really fall in love with this kind of new music, this experimental music?
Oh, back in 1990, I was sort of at a crossroads in my playing and not doing very well. But I found and discovered through freestyle improvisation and through some concerts that I actually had an excellent talent for playing contemporary music. And once I discovered that, you know, my midlife crisis was solved and I moved forward with great energy, and I haven't really stopped since.
So you discovered that you had a talent for playing this kind of music. Was this a kind of music that you were actively seeking out and listening to for your own enjoyment?
I have to admit, I really rather liked it. You know, our modern contemporary music runs a gamut from dissonant to minimal to highly complex to, there are very simple things, to electronics, to all sorts and manner of stuff. On the cello, I am known for what are called extended techniques, and I play the instrument in unusual fashions, and many times present my own freestyle improvisation where, you know, instead of playing nice, beautiful string sounds, sometimes I'll make a scratch or bump or other noises on the instrument, and that's sort of a little bit like some of the noises we have around us in our daily lives here at this time.
So, speaking of that, since we are often surrounded by electronic noise and that kind of thing, you feel like this, in a way, is the sound of our time?
For sure, that's what art is. You know, that's why we practice these art forms of music and literature and dance and theater. And movies and film is, you know, these are the emblems of our own time. You know, in the time of Beethoven, you know, he went for a carriage ride out in the country, and it came down into the Pastoral Symphony. Well, now we do that. It's in the pickup truck down the gravel road, and so our sounds are a little bit different now than they were back then, and so our music is also reflective of that. You know, I have to admit, you know, electricity is one of the biggest impacts that has ever happened in our artistic world. And, you know, electronics, our ability to listen to recordings, media, it's a, you know, modern music is, you know, sounds modern because it is of our own time.
Now, you, in coming back to Decora and you know, spending time working on the farm, have you been able to connect with local musicians who also share this kind of interest?
Oh, sure. I've joined the local community orchestra, the Oneota Valley Community Orchestra. I now play in once a week there. We rehearse on Sundays, and I'm on the board of directors there. And I'm also I've met Brooke Joyce, who's the composer in residence at Luther College here in Decorah, and he is chair of the Iowa Composers Forum, and I think he is grooming me to become chair of that composers organization here, maybe in 2019. So, the networking has been important. I lived for many years in the South, and know those people and connections down there well. But it's been very interesting and engaging for me to start to do that work up here as well.
Now, tell me more about the network that you work with nationally, because you also travel to perform and to work with composers around the country.
Yeah, that's one of the nice things of no longer being in the professional orchestra is my ability to put together strings of concert dates and, you know, allow works to have more than just one performance. And, you know, I've been active for decades, and I know a lot of people all over the country and the world. And now I get a chance to go see them and play some of the works that they have written. In last month, in January, I played in New York City and looped that together with another performance in Kalamazoo. Here this month, I did a tour of Florida and played in Jacksonville and Pensacola. Next month, I'll be playing in Chicago, Indianapolis, Bloomington, Illinois, and probably return here for a final performance of that tour in Decorah.
With coming back to Iowa, spending time helping out on the farm, how do you find that farm work and your music pursuits work together? Is there a symbiosis there?
Sometimes. Anybody who's been on a farm knows that sometimes the work knows no boundaries here. You know, especially when we got a tree down over in the windbreak or over a fence line. Sometimes that takes quite a bit of work. But you know, in many respects, it clears my head and allows me to when I come back into the music studio to really enjoy it. And so it's, you know, I have a balance in my life. We have an eighth of a mile of lane that we have to plow out of snow to get out to the gravel road. There's about 4 acres of grass in the summer that needs to be cut. You know, fences to be mended, you know, barns to be painted, all that kind of stuff. And that's real physical work. It does keep me in some decent physical condition. But then in the late afternoon, when I finally get done with my chores, I'm down there in the studio, and that's probably when I'm at my best as a person, when I'm the instrument making sound.
Now, we've talked about your cello and an electric cello. What other instruments do you work with?
Well, I have several acoustic instruments. I have an old Italian composite cello from 1800 that I got in 2001 from Christie's East in Chicago, I mean in New York, and that's a beautiful, glorious sounding instrument, and I do love the acoustic instrument. You know, it's got a 300-year-old heritage, and it's deserved it. Acoustic instruments are fantastic. My electric instrument is very interesting to look at. It's a little bit different to have to play it because it has none of the overtones quite that the golden acoustic instruments possess.
So what does it look like?
My electric instrument looks like an anchor. It's just got some ribs. It has no body. Some ribs for the knees to hold on to, and the fingerboard and the bridge. But it's an instrument without it's sort of like a skeleton of an instrument, because what's active are the pickups underneath the strings and the bridge, and that's the only thing really you need, and plus the fingerboard to stop the pitches.
Now, you have certainly been in the music business long enough to know that there are many people who, when they hear somebody talking about or playing experimental music, pretty much dismiss it right away as something that they're not interested in. In trying to bring a listener into this with an open mind, how would you recommend someone experience experimental music?
Well, I would call it the art of discovery, and that, you know, we listen in different manners. There's sometimes we listen with nostalgia. We like certain songs because they remind us of a certain time or emotion from past experiences. There is sometimes we listen to just the prettiness of it. Sometimes I think there's an interest in discovering where one is going to end up after one has started. And, we have now a whole bunch of different compositional ideas that fuel our contemporary music. And sometimes they are very mathematical, very heady, sometimes difficult to grasp. But my countenance to people listening to new music is to listen for the voice and to discover, to make a discovery with your ears as to what might come next and why does that happen.
All right, we're going to go out with a song called Beatlings by David Morneau. Tell us a little bit about this piece.
David Morneau is a New York composer. This is a piece for interactive computer software and electric cello. The application is called Ableton Live, and what that allows for me, and when we talk about interactive, it means that I can trigger different parts of the music with a foot pedal.
Okay.
And this is what the composer calls minimal New York dance music.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Craig.
Certainly, Charity. My privilege.
Craig Hultgren calls himself a farmer cellist. He lives in Decorah, helps out on the family farm, and also travels the country performing experimental music on his cello. We'll listen as we go out today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
All of the food in the world comes from water and carbon dioxide and minerals, from the work of chlorophyll. We'll be right back.